Thank you very much for the kind invitation to be here among you. It's a real great pleasure. I'll talk briefly about what happened in Egypt and what the significance for this to people's health and to the global health. To start, I'm working for several years right now with People's Health Movement. It is a global network bringing together the health activists in large academia, civil society organizations, and when we're talking about civil society organizations, we specifically talk about public interest and not those civil society organizations that are affiliated to corporates. It has a presence in more than 70 countries. It works towards health for all through revitalizing the primary health care as articulated in the Alma-Ata Declaration in 1978, and to address the social determinants of health. And here, when we're talking about social determinants of health, we mean the political context, the economic factors, and the social. The People's Health Movement works through country-specific activities, but also global programs, among them the Global Health Watch, which is an alternative World Health Report. It's being published every 2 years. Till the moment, we have three volumes. The first one was published in 2005, and then 2008, and one in 2011. And it's not only an alternative analysis to this of the WHO, but also it's an alternative process. So we try to capture the living conditions of people in different countries, and we have lots of testimonies. We have the International People's Health University, which is a virtual university for health activists, a right to health campaign in many countries, and we have a new global health governance initiative, which is focusing right now on watching the World Health Organization to have it accountable to its constitution and to play a better role in the global health more than the Bretton Woods institutions. And this is our website. To start talking about Egypt, I would love to start with a historical, very quick historical background to understand what happened. In 1952, it was the army movement, and the significance of this era was the nationalism, the spread of nationalism, and the move towards the Arab unity. So after this army movement, Egypt became a republic. It was a kingdom before that, and it's the end of British colony in 1956, and the revolution in Egypt, or this, I prefer to name it army movement instead of revolution, it supported many national liberation movements and the non-aligned movement. There was a significant economic growth, specifically in relation to the agriculture reform, like limitation of the land ownership, central planning for the agriculture. There was a move of for industry, and it depends to great extent, and this was a big mistake, on technology transfer. So this army movement didn't think for the future, and they didn't try to make the basis for creation of science. We depended to great extent on technology transfer, which at this time it was okay. Right now it's not, because of the intellectual property right, which is another story. There was limited political space. We had one party at this time, one political party, and the right to expression was not very protected. In 1967, And this is we had a word we use in Egypt, which I failed to translate very well. But in this time, Egypt was beaten by Israel in a big war. It didn't take a lot of time, but it had lots of complications on Egypt after that. And it resulted in occupation of parts of Egypt, was Sinai basically, parts of Syria, Palestine, and so on. And we started a war economy. In 1973, this was the second war with Israel, and Egypt could win in this war. We could liberate a limited part of Sinai, but this was the beginning of working towards peace, which is peace between governments. Till now, it's not a real peace, till the moment. Actually, you can see here the dates. In 1973, it was a war, and 1 year after, the Egyptian leader at this time, called Sadat, started the open door policies. So the whole war was, to great extent, to have a very quick victory after that, to move from the eastern camp, from the eastern camp, which is dominated by the Soviet Union, to the western camp. So he started the open door policy, and this time was associated with sending lots of workforce from Egypt to the oil estates in the Arab Gulf. And this was quite significant in the Egyptian history because we exported the well-trained workforce we have. In addition, they returned back to Egypt with money, which helped in stratifying the societies. But the most important, they came back with the culture of fundamentalism, which affected the future of Egypt to a great extent. In 1979, very rapidly, we have the bilateral peace agreement with Israel, and it was a bilateral peace agreement. This means that it was between Israel and Egypt, and this was a huge mistake because it didn't solve the conflict in the Middle East. I would say it increased. It made it worse after this peace agreement because it only contributed to the isolation of Egypt from the Middle East conflict. And immediately after that, Egypt was rejected from the Arab League and was completely outside. And you may know that there were three big countries in the region: Egypt, Syria, and Iraq. And it was very necessary for the North to deal with them each in a time. Egypt was isolated by what's called peace agreement, which is only between the governments, never been popular in Egypt. There is no naturalization in Egypt at all. There is no acceptance till the moment to this peace agreement, while Palestine and parts of Syria are still occupied, while Palestinians are being killed every day in Gaza and the West Bank. The Egyptian leader at this time, Sadat, moved very rapidly to the market economy. And you can imagine, after many years of war economy, we are moving rapidly to the market, which caused a lot of inequalities. And he was helped by those people he sent to the oil countries, and they came back with money. So it started a new class in Egypt. And this new class was formed from those who went to the Gulf. This was a portion of them. the bureaucrats who were a part of the authority during the military era and the originally rich people in Egypt during the kingdom. So these were the three main sources of the new class in Egypt at this time. Sadat needed to get rid of the remnants of communism and socialism in Egypt. And the solution was to cultivate the fundamentalism, which actually the Egyptian police and the Egyptian governor at this time cultivated this fundamentalism in each of the universities in Egypt. They started with the universities till it grows very, very rapidly, and they killed Sadat in 1981. And this is not surprising, because fundamentalism need an enemy to grow. So it's the same like what happened in Afghanistan. For a very long time, Al-Qaeda was supported by the North to fight against the Soviet Union. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, Al-Qaeda needed an enemy. That simple. And the enemy was the US and Europe. And it starts from here. So the same happened in Egypt. The regime supported the cultivation of the fundamentalism. And when they get rid of the socialism and communism in Egypt, they needed an enemy. And the enemy was the leader himself who cultivated them. In early 80s, Sadat started to make some political reform, and the political space was a little wider. And we started in Egypt to lose the social protection. We lost all the social protection gradually that we enjoyed during the 60s. In late 80s, we started the structural readjustment program, and this means we implement the recipes of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. Basically, meaning that education is not a right, health is not a right, they became commodity people should pay for, and we should open more space for the private sector. And opening space for the private sector didn't mean in Egypt to allow private sector to invest, but actually to privatize the public facilities. This means all facilities that people paid for a long time to establish them were sold out, I would say free, in many cases, to the private sector. And this was the recipe of the Bretton Woods institutions. In the 90s, the waves of corruption increased till we reached the oligarchy, which is the complete marriage between the authority and wealth. And the story of Mubarak's son started to be on the top. He wants his son to follow him, and he's going to do whatever needed to make this happen. And to make it happen, he has to get the support of the North. And getting the support of the North, meaning that he needs to play a certain role in the Middle East. Basically, to align all the Middle Eastern countries with the US and European policies. Without Egypt, it was quite difficult to have the Gulf Wars, or at least to have the Gulf Wars that peaceful in the region without any objection from the other countries. I should say that there were huge protests during the first Gulf War against Iraq, but the oppression from police was very huge as well, and all voices were filled out. One example for health. During just before the revolution, there was a trial to have health insurance law, and this health insurance law used some slogans that can be pretty, like separation between the finance and the service delivery. Actually, they were separated in Egypt, so there was no need to separate them, but this they meant to convert the health insurance organization, which was a public service provider, to a health fund. This means that this organization is going to lose all the facilities people paid for, and these facilities are going to act as separated facilities. Each of them should be financially separated. This means each of them should have its own cost recovery mechanisms. And because they are very small and there was a hierarchy in the system, they will not be able to compete, and after a while they are going to be sold out. Purchasing the service based on competition, this means to start monopolies. And actually, in 1 year, there were 18 facilities with investment by Saudi Arabia and Germany established in Cairo. So the monopolies started to get prepared, because this law aimed at having a big pool of money in one place. The out-of-pocket expenditures in Egypt was very huge. It reached 62% of the total social expenditures on health. And the out-of-pocket is very, very difficult to regulate. It's very difficult to attract foreign investments. But if we get this money in one pool, we are welcoming the foreign companies to come and take the money. And this is what's happening in many places, including the U.S. I mean, one of the examples, during the in the middle of the recession in 2009, the biggest five health insurance companies in the U.S. made 56 more as net profit, while people is losing their jobs here, but they are getting more profit out of people's pains. And this applies to the pharmaceutical companies this law said that people should pay 30% of the cost of the medical interventions, and this means that we are punishing people based on the type of illness they have. Because if a child was born with congenital heart disease and he needed a surgery, and this surgery is very high, the parent should pay 30%. And if the child is normal, parents will not pay. So it's a punishment to the family. And the study, the financial study of this health insurance, was made by McKinsey, which is a British company, and it's a long story to talk about what these companies are doing in the health sector reforms in many, many countries in the third world. Basically, it aligned the policies with the Bretton Woods organization's recipes, the World Bank, IMF, and WTO. Very quickly, Egypt was not in control of its land. I mean, we have no control on Sinai because of the peace agreement. We cannot put a soldier there. And Sinai, after the peace agreement, it's just a land. We have some places for tourists. That's it. Nothing more. No real effort for development, and we are prevented from doing it. We are not in control. We are losing our leading position in the region. Privatization is very massive, and the access to basic service is being denied. The economy, we have economic growth, But the number of people who are failing under the poverty line are increasing. This means that the gaps between the poor and rich is widened. We have corruption and oppression. These were the reasons of the revolution. The revolution called for freedom and social justice. So it wasn't only, and this is very important, it wasn't only against the dictatorship or the oppression. It was against the injustice, the social injustice in the society. It was against the recipes from outside to privatize health, water, education, and so on. And it was against the growing inequalities. So the first slogan for the revolution was the social justice. But of course, we cannot reach the social justice with the oppression. We need the freedom as well. What happens? After 18 days of the number of people in the streets reached in one day 16 million people in Egypt, in everywhere, and it was no return back. People decide they are going to stay in the street till Mubarak leaves. And there was no choice for the outsiders to continue support Mubarak. Lots of countries, including the US administration, supported Mubarak in the beginning. But when it went out of control, there was no choice. The regime had to get rid of Mubarak to protect itself. And this basically what happened in Egypt. We didn't get rid of the regime. We just got rid of Mubarak. And the regime continues in form of the army, which is a part of the regime, even with more conservative behavior. The army leaders are a part of the oligarchy that was established in Egypt. They are a part of the combination between the wealth and the authority. Why should they try to make any democracy? The North, according to Noam Chomsky, needs dictatorships in the region. It's easier to control. If we can imagine that Egypt, Yemen, Tunisia, Syria, and Libya are going to form democracies and people are going to be in control, the peace with Israel is not going to continue. Simply. Because people in these countries will never agree on having thousands of Palestinians being killed. The occupation of the US to Iraq will be a big problem. Because people will not allow that the price of oil, the money of Iraq's oil, only 18% of it goes to the nation and 80% goes to the multinational companies. This will not be allowed. So it will be a regional revolution against the neoliberalism and against the military face of neoliberalism. And this is very dangerous for the North. That's why it's much easier to support recreation of these regimes with new faces to ensure the reality. And this is what's being happening. In Egypt, the army is in charge for 8 months right now, more, and they are going to continue. And all the promises that in 6 months it will be a peaceful transition and so on, these are just words. And the army is being supported from outside very, very much. Even after killing, the army killed 25 Christians 2 weeks ago. And the north kept silent. Nobody's talking about that. Nobody's talking about the oppression right now in Egypt. In Syria, the same. Nobody wants to rush a reform, a political reform in Syria. Nobody wants to stop the killing people, killing civilians in Syria because of the fear of what's next. If Assad is outside, who is going to be in charge? There is a risk that Syria starts a new social state, which is the North, made a lot of effort to make the transition from the socialism to the capitalism in this particular state, Syria. What's going to happen if the people in this region try to support people in Iraq to end the occupation? So it's easier to have the dictatorship, but the good news that people are still in the streets, are still in Tahrir Square, and we started 1 week ago to have slogans against the military government. So people will not accept that the regime is being recreated again. And this is the only thing that can protect Egypt right now. There is no other guarantees. No support from outside will make any difference in Egypt right now, because there are big interests against the democracy in the Middle East. Thank you very much.